Hello, and welcome to More Than a Movie, the weekly show about films and filmmaking here on Campus FM. My name's Andrew Bonello, and along with the guest I'll welcome onto the show very soon, we'll take a journey into the magical world of movies to explore why films can be such a powerful reflection of real life's struggles and joys, making them so much more than just a movie. Today, let's train the lens on film noir and golden Hollywood oldies. More mature listeners will be aware that there's a huge collection of superb titles from the 1940s through to the 70s. But how many younger film viewers today really appreciate them? Yes, we may sidestep some of film noir's more celebrated tropes, Private Detective Philip Marlowe, anyone? But with a bit of help from our studio guest, allow us to tempt you with some cinematic trendsetters of yesteryear, films which are still highly influential even today. Coming up just a little later on, Has a River Voyage finally presented one of cinema's most boisterous sleuths with more than he can deduce?
Lucky? With me, it's the exercise of the little grey cells. Luck, I leave to the others.
Yes, I've forgotten your opinion about yourself.
Oh, yeah.
A pair of young lovers get into more than a little hot water.
Well, you suggested it yourself once, didn't you?
I was only joking.
Were you?
Yes, I was.
Or had you started to think about it a little?
Maybe I said it, but I didn't really mean it.
Well, I say it again now, and I do mean it.
And a Hollywood has-been tries anything to rekindle an ailing acting career.
Used to be in silent pictures, used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I knew there was something wrong.
But before we get to all that, let me introduce our guest this week. Anthony Eadridge trained in the Circle in the Square Theatre School in New York City. He worked for many years as a theatre, television and film actor in the United Kingdom. He was also a drama coach and workshop director with a strong focus on Shakespeare. Anthony relocated to Malta in 2016, where he continues performing in local theatre and film productions. And he joins me in the studio today. Anthony, welcome.
Good morning, Andrew.
Great to have you here, Anthony. Thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
A great pleasure. So, Anthony, to start with, tell us a little about how your love for film, the cinematic medium, was born.
I suppose I used to spend quite a lot of time in front of the TV, and it dates me somewhat, but in those days, what you used to get quite a lot of, apart from Blue Peter and Cracker Jack and things, was old movies.
Right.
And I found them fascinating from the off. I could sit and watch, and still do, sit and watch endless old black and white movies.
And so do you remember a particular title that you saw as a young man that really stuck with you, that really struck you?
I think that fairly early on I was quite captivated by the Private Eye, so something like The Maltese Falcon would be an early an early sort of detective movie that I loved. And I still find those kind of movies the most compelling for me today.
So sort of the classic Humphrey Bogart sort of film noir type characterization. That's
absolutely. Although Humphrey Bogart now isn't really one of my favorite leading men, but yes, that sort of thing, the post-war years and pre-war years when they were still filming in black and white, and these great contrasted black and white dramatic movies are endlessly interesting.
Indeed, and we'll hopefully touch on just a few of them a bit later on in the show and talk about noir a little bit itself, I hope. So, but to talk for a little bit about your own experience, I mentioned in the intro that beyond performing yourself, you're also a seasoned educator and coach in acting and drama. Indeed, you were a GCSE performance examination director at the Eastwood School in Essex in the UK. Tell us a little bit about that. What was the process of assessment for students and how did you get involved?
That was great. A friend of mine called Richard Foster was the head of English and drama at Eastwood, and he got me involved. They had a weekly allocation of time to do their devised theatre pieces, and what he did was he put it all together in a long weekend, and we'd all go off and have a residential weekend somewhere and put together little pieces for them. And we also directed them in shows. I did an all-girl version of Bouncers, which was quite odd. Especially as one of the scenes is the four bouncers in a urinal.
Gosh.
So I had to get the girls, teach the girls how to pee like a man.
Interesting.
It was quite fun. Yeah, we produced some lovely little pieces with these Essex kids who were fabulously enthusiastic.
So these residential trips you mentioned, it was a process of sort of mentoring them and working to develop them at the rehearsal stage prior to the actual performance assessment?
Or? Yes. A lot of it actually was sort of police work, trying to keep them in bed after 10 o'clock. Yes, then we would spend Friday and Saturday and then Sunday morning rehearsing and putting things together and hoping that they didn't have a change of heart halfway through, which always spelled absolute disaster. And then on Sunday afternoon, we'd have a show and tell, and all the kids would produce their pieces.
Terrific. I see. Very interesting. And so related to that, for Southend Council, you ran many Shakespeare workshops for youngsters between the ages of 8 and 18 years old.
Yeah.
What inspired that, and how did you introduce such young, you know, thespians to this very sophisticated literary work?
Well, it was all the inspiration of a girl called Nikki Reeder, who was a keen local amateur, and she was in close touch with the Palace Theatre in Westcliff, where I was working. And she did all the approaching of the schools. What we did was basically get kids on their feet. It involved very careful selection of scenes, so we used to try and pick funny, grotesque, not too serious scenes. So we would, you know, the Mechanicals from Midsummer Night's Dream was always fun. And then we literally would just do it once for them.
Like perform it.
Perform it. Yep, okay. Absolutely. And then get them on their feet and divide them into little groups and rehearse them a bit. And then again, show and tell. Showtime.
Very cool. So in other words, you were choosing, choice moments from some of Shakespeare's most celebrated.
And short.
Right. Short, brief, digestible pieces that kids can hopefully have fun with.
Absolutely. Hopefully funny, yeah.
Great. So obviously then Shakespeare is one of your great loves as a performer, as an actor. Like yourself, English is my native tongue. I have to say, I've read a fair bit of Shakespeare over the years. It's not exactly easygoing in terms of the prose, right? I mean, it's quite challenging language, even for a native English speaker. Did that come into things with your students? I mean, was there a lot of reading of the texts involved? And how did that all work in terms of the interpretation of those texts?
Yeah, I only claim really to know the shows, that know the plays of Shakespeare that I've actually done, because working with Joe Harmsden in Tour de Force, we would spend probably the first week of rehearsals sitting down and going over the text just to make sure that we understood it.
Fair enough.
So that was one of the reasons that we picked short scenes for the kids. But I remember working with a guy called Adrian Metcalf, whose first job whenever he was given a Shakespearean role was to go through it and look for the knob gags.
Okay.
Of which there are abundant.
Right.
But once, they say that Shakespeare, and this is true, Shakespeare is actually quite a lot easier to learn than a lot of contemporary plays, especially less well-written plays, because of the greatness of the writing. It slots in the way that Shakespeare wrote it. Quite often.
So this is interesting, because I do quite a lot of reading around a sort of narrative structure and screenplay theory, and it seems that quite a lot of the analysts suggest that one of the reasons Shakespeare is so popularized, even all this time after his work, is because he was such a master of structure and sort of these central kind of mythical story structures that we, frankly, we see repeated in so many modern films and theatre plays.
Yeah.
Would you argue that's one of the main reasons he's so, like, why is he so celebrated today, Shakespeare?
I honestly don't know why Shakespeare is, as I say, the only plays really that I know are the ones that I've done. And I'm no great expert on Shakespeare at all.
Yeah.
But it is always such a delight when you do them, to find out just how good they are.
How well written.
How well written. How well they hang together. Why the scenes are in the order that they are and so on. Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly, he's referenced, and you know, there's a debate about three-act versus five-act structure in film. But, I mean, Shakespeare's sort of been coined as the master of the five-act sort of story beats, and he's constantly coming up in examples in these various books. Very interesting. So, in terms of acting in theatre, Anthony, you've done quite a bit of Shakespeare as a performer, as well as Jane Austen, you've done national tours, you appeared at the Edinburgh Festival. Tell me a bit about what the magic of theatre as a performer is for you. Do you have fond moments and performances that really stick in your mind?
I had one year, 1995 was an extraordinary year. I did a show which was written by a young American fella who was an ex-Navy pilot. And he decided to do the show in London because the critics can kill a show in a day in New York. So he decided to go to London. We rehearsed in a freezing cold little room in Islington and put this show on in February, March 1995. And it was, broadly speaking, Gays in the Military, which was a huge hot potato at the time. Mm. And became a sort of cause célèbre amongst the gay community in London, and was then picked up and transferred to the Haymarket.
Right.
And I can remember going to the Haymarket to check out the dressing rooms one day and getting to the top of the Haymarket, the Piccadilly Circus, looking down the Haymarket and seeing my face on a sort of 9-foot by 9-foot canvas poster hanging between the great arches of the Haymarket Theatre and falling about laughing. And being looked askance at by all the tourists who are wandering up and down the Haymarket. So I tried to pull myself together, and I kept having these fits of the giggles walking down. Just
you couldn't believe it?
Believe it. It was just extraordinary to see me, 9-foot by 9-foot, massive close-up. And I can remember, I can't quite tell you on air what my friend Martin McDougall said about how he felt as we were waiting to go on at the Haymarket. The show involved nudity and so on.
Right.
But the thrill of that opening night was just mind-blowing. I actually don't remember a lot of what happened after we finished the show.
Must have been an electric atmosphere.
It was, yeah. Absolutely electric, you know.
Fascinating. Well, look, Anthony, so we're going to move on to some of your other experience in TV and film very shortly, but today's show we're talking about film noir and golden Hollywood oldies. Is there a film that sort of falls into that category that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Yeah, you asked me about this, and I picked Out of the Past or Build My Gallows High.
I could have run away last night.
I'd find you.
Yes, I believe you would. You're glad you did?
I don't know.
I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know anything except how much I hated it. But I didn't take anything. I didn't, Jenny. Won't you believe me?
Baby, I don't care.
So from 1947, this is Jacques Tournier's film, starring Robert Mitchum, Jane Greer, and even Kirk Douglas. So, can you summarize the brief story set up for us for this film, Anthony, and tell us what you loved about it?
Yeah, sure. It fits deliciously into all the various noir criteria. Robert Mitchum is a guy with a past. He's found a happy life with a girlfriend and a business, a little gas station in rural Montana or something. And a fellow pops up from his past. And he's dragged back into the mire and the criminality of his old boss, Kirk Douglas, and his old flame, Jane Greer. It's just brilliant. It's that feeling that when the protagonist first sees that woman, the wrong woman, that you just know it ain't gonna end well.
It's all gonna end so horribly.
Yeah. And there's a great moment when Mitchum's in Mexico and he's been hanging around in this bar waiting for this girl to appear, and it's got a first-person voiceover, which is terrific. And Mitchum says, "And then I saw her. And I realized why," and I can't remember Kirk Douglas's character now, Wit, that's right. And I realized why Wit didn't care about the $40,000.
Mm.
And in comes Jane Greer and gets her Cuba Libre.
To get nerdy just for a minute, Anthony, the definition of film noir, whilst debated, can roughly be summarised as a cinematographic film marked by a mood of pessimism, fatalism, nihilism and menace, with its cinematographic roots in German Expressionism. In that light, your film Out of the Past, how exactly does it sort of epitomise those aspects of the film noir genre?
Yeah, somebody once wittily called it suffering in style.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's the femme fatale, there's the guy who has the possibility to have a happy, normal and long life, who, because of circumstances, gets dragged into a whirlpool of self-destruction. Out of the Past just fits all of these. They sometimes say that the film noir needs flashback. 40 minutes of the first hour of the movie is flashback. How did Mitchum get involved with these people? And the femme fatale, played by a 22-year-old Jane Greer, is brilliant. She doesn't look as sort of glamorous as the sort of peroxide Lana Turner from, mm-hmm. say, Postman Always Rings Twice. But she's nonetheless deadly.
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 Indeed.
And it's that thing, no matter how many times you watch it, you're never quite sure until it all goes wrong that Mitchum isn't going to somehow pull himself out of the dive and go the sensible route. The cinematography is great in it. The contrast between the wide open outdoor spaces of I think it's Montana, and Mexico, contrasted with the interiors, those beautifully contrasted, sharply lit, smoke-filled interiors. There's a critic who talks about how Kirk Douglas and Robert Mitchum duel with cigarettes. That the smoking is a sort of battle. So visually it's great, the story is great, and the wit of the script is just dazzling.
Beat it. Look at all the angles. You know wit and you know how far he can reach. So just pay me off and I'm quiet. But use cash. Don't try to pay me off with pitch handed to you with this cheap piece of baggage.
Very cool. Interesting also that you mentioned the aspect of flashbacks. That is to say, even film noir was playing around a lot with the sort of the narrative ordering and chronology, yeah, of films, even back in the 40s and beyond. So,
and always filmed on location. That was something that became never studio. And that was something that came, I think, economically, because most of them being filmed sort of from the Second World War onwards, it was cheap to film on location. Of course, the studios and the kit was all in Los Angeles. So Los Angeles became the sort of backdrop of these movies.
Fascinating. Well, thank you for that, Anthony. Let's move on to talk about some more of your work now. You did a lot of TV roles back in the UK. I mean, we've got, for people who are familiar with British television, there's some really well-known titles here. The Bill for ITV, Casualty for the BBC, Coronation Street on Granada Television. I mean, the list goes on and on. Tell us a bit about your TV work. How did that come about?
The show that I was talking about earlier, Burning Blue, which I did in 1995, brought me to the attention of London casting directors, TV and film casting directors. So before that, I'd done very little. I used to alternate between doing fringe theatre, which my commercials agent, the much lamented Hugh Galloway, used to get me in here. And he would always go, "Oh God, Tony, you don't have to go and do another fringe play, do you?" And I thought, "Well, yes, I have to. So I would do commercials which would support the fringe work. And then one of these fringe plays, you know, did turn into a huge hit. And so then I started to get the TVs, like you mentioned, the Corries and the Bills and the odd movie when they were being filmed in London. So 1995 was a sort of watershed.
Okay. That's sort of the year you kind of got a bit of a break
in
the industry.
Absolutely, yeah.
Interesting. So moving from there towards film, I mean, I noticed on your filmography you had a role, I don't know how big of a role, in Catherine Bigelow's military film, Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah.
Well, Catherine Bigelow, of course, Oscar-winning director for an earlier film she made, I think it was The Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
Tell us about that role. How did it come about?
I auditioned probably a year before I got it with a speech from The Hurt Locker. And I hadn't seen The Hurt Locker. I then saw The Hurt Locker and thought, hang on a second, I know this dialogue. Mm. And then a little while later, I got the part. I was playing an American general who was responsible for the modifying of the helicopters that were used in the raid on Bin Laden's headquarters. And so I had this scene where it was almost the entire cast of the movie, about an hour and 40 minutes in, is assembled in a vast hangar in the Jordanian desert. Unfortunately, they went around the entire cast reminding the audience of who everybody is. So you don't see me very much, but I'm talking a lot of technical nonsense about helicopters in a very sharply pressed set of fatigues with two stars on it. We arrived in costume at the Jordanian parachute regiment base in the middle of the desert, and I was mooching about, drinking coffee and wearing this uniform, and there were a lot of American personnel there, non-commissioned officers and privates, and one of the sparks said to me, Tony, the American personnel on the base are really upset that they weren't notified that there was going to be a two-star general on the base. And so I started looking around at these little huddles of American, scruffy-looking American guys. And every time I'd look at them, they'd sort of shuffle and get nervous and try and look like they were busy doing something. And eventually, I walked over to a group of them who were clearly dying, thinking, oh, no.
We blew it.
And I walked over and said, chaps, you can relax. I'm not a general. I'm just an actor. And this one guy said, really? And I said, yeah, absolutely, just an actor. And he ripped this flash off my shoulder, which was Velcroed on, turned it round, and smacked it back on, and had been driving me nuts all day.
So they helped to sort of correct your uniform,
in fact. Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
And Catherine Bigelow was a very, very odd person to work for. I remember something that gives you an insight into Catherine Bigelow. We were standing, the two of us, outside the hangar, and there was a big C-130, a big cargo plane, right, coming in to land. And Catherine was standing there with her baseball cap and her dark glasses, and she's about 6 foot tall. And she just went all sort of moony and went, oh, here comes my C-130. Thing that, you know, military hardware turns her on.
How interesting. Mm. Okay. And you've obviously worked with many directors for both TV, theatre and film. How did she compare? Like, is she an intense sort of hands-on kind of director? Does she tend to delegate a lot? I mean, can you talk about
that? She was working very closely with her assistant director and co-producer, whose name Mark somebody, I can't remember. Mm. But she didn't give me very much direction, but I just had this speech, which I'd been woken up at 11 o'clock the previous night to be given by a member of her team. And it was quite technical, and I thought I was doing it perfectly. And as I say, the entire cast of the movie was there, you know, Mark Strong, Jessica Chastain. Mm. And she walked over to me and said, Tony, I want us to get this speech absolutely right. And she took her script, and with her finger underneath each word, she read through the whole speech, pointing at each word as she said it. I've never been so mortified in front of such a distinguished crowd in my life.
Was the purpose to give a precise intonation and
no,
emphasis,
it was just to make sure that I had read every word.
I see, just to get the actual script wording correct.
And I thought I was getting it right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Gosh. Now, and that presumably was in an American accent.
Yeah.
You were playing an American military.
Yes, I played quite a lot of foreigners.
Right, so that brings me, actually, Anthony, onto another of your films. Back in episode one of this season of our show, I discussed Mix Up in the Mediterranean, which is a Hallmark movie that was shot here in Malta at the end of 2020, released early 2021. And I was watching this film and saw the father figure of the main female protagonist in the film, and suddenly I realized, I was like, this is a nice performance. I was like, holy crap, goodness me, this is Anthony. I know this man. He's an actor. How did that role come about?
The usual way. Yeah, Edward Said, I think, got me in for that. And, yeah, I read for the dad and the German organizer. I had great fun reading for that. I did him rather camp. I was encouraged by the director, actually, to do him rather camp in the interview. But they gave me the part of the dad.
Right.
Which was great fun. It was a lovely, lovely set. They were so calm and so relaxed, and yet managed to produce this thing in, I think, 17 days or something.
Astonishing, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And talking about directors and their styles, Jonathan Wright, I believe, was the director of this feature. How was working with him? What's his kind of method of working?
Very, very calm.
Hmm. Is that because they're so organized, or is it his actual natural demeanor? Or?
He seemed like a very calm person, a very kind person. There was no sort of Napoleonic-type behavior ever. I guess he's got a crew that he's worked with a lot. There's a lot of shorthanding that, you know, and that it's one of the things I love about working on film sets. The first filming I did was commercials, where I was the only actor, so I was able to stand in the middle of this apparently rather chaotic procedure and just see how it all worked. And I'd be talking with a Sparks, who would break off mid-word from a story he was telling and go because somebody had called him. And they are incredibly disciplined machines.
So interesting that you were on a commercial set as the only actor, but you still had the sort of presence of mind to observe what was going on around you, because there's so many roles on a film set or a TV or commercial set, so many different people doing different things.
Right? Yeah. And well, that's it. Well, it does look chaotic when before, and if you are able to stand in the middle of it without the distraction of other actors, you do start to see how it all works and why some people are standing around at certain points and why some people are frantically moving about. It was great. And that thing of always having one ear cocked for the boss's voice.
Right. Because there is a head honcho. There is someone running the whole thing.
Yeah, well, there are department heads. I mean, the gaffer is a very important person on the set, and the first AD and so on. But it's very rare that anyone actually has to shout for someone to get someone's attention. People are usually listening. And it's an odd thing, because the other thing about film sets is that a lot of the people involved look like they, unless film had come along and rescued them, they might have gone a bit the film noir way. There's a slight sort of criminal element about it.
Interesting, right. And talking about your performance in that film, Mix Up in the Mediterranean, were you happy with the performance when you saw it subsequently?
Yeah, I'm not crazy about watching myself on film, but yeah, I didn't have the that awful thing of, oh, Jesus, why did I do that?
You didn't dislike it?
I didn't dislike it, no.
Right. Very good. Fantastic. Well, I mean, I really liked that performance, so well done. Anthony, this was really very interesting. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today about your extensive experience and work. If people who've been listening are interested to find out a little bit more about you, is there somewhere online they can go to find out about more of your work?
Yeah, sure. I've got a website, which is www.anthonyeedridge.co.uk. Anthony without an H.
So that's right, Anthony without an H.
And Ed listeners. Ridge.
So ANTONYEDRIDGE.co.uk.
That's it.
I think I've got it. Fantastic. Well, thank you again, Anthony. We wish you the very best of luck with your film and your theatre work. We hope we'll be seeing lots more of you up on screen on our televisions and hopefully the big screen very soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you for having me.
A pleasure. Time for a quick musical interlude now. This is taken from the soundtrack of one of our upcoming movies, soon to be revealed. Let's see if any of you recognize it. The composer is Frank Skinner. Now then, what about film noir and golden oldies that were shot here in Malta? Well, as we've mentioned in past episodes, lots of films centred on military history were shot here in Malta, particularly in the mid-20th century. One stood out, though, for this episode. An American destroyer captain is determined to confront a Soviet submarine caught violating territorial waters. But is he, perhaps, a little too determined?
I'm proud to be an old-fashioned patriot, and I'd destroy any enemy if it meant saving my country. Now, what in the hell is wrong with that?
But how far would you go to destroy that enemy?
All the way.
Munsford, the correspondent who had covered all kinds of stories, but none like this.
I'd like to ask you some questions.
For your story?
No, off the record, for me. For instance, what is going on?
The key links in the chain of command that must hold out through the hell they call the Bedford Incident.
So, from 1965, this is the Bedford Incident, and indeed, this title arguably would have also fit into episode 6 of our show, Movies Diving Beneath the Waves. The Bedford Incident starred Richard Widmark, himself no stranger at all to noir, having been Oscar-nominated for his role in 1947's Kiss of Death. Sidney Poitier co-stars, yes, he who of course went on to star in the classic 1967 drama Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, as well as In the Heat of the Night from that same year. Well, the Bedford Incident was partially shot at the water tanks down near Fort Rinella, as well as in Shepperton Studios back in the United Kingdom. And I've not seen this one, but I'll tell you what, from that trailer, it looks like a bit of a sizzler, and then some. So for classic naval drama drifting into noir thriller waters, you might want to take a dive into the Bedford Incident.
And the Observer, one-time enemy, now alleged ally, a German commander in the free world's high command.
You are in the power here, Eric. It is not a force. It is just you.
You mean you're trying to say that you consider me desperate?
No, Captain. To be frank, I consider you frightening.
Port lookout! Snorkel broad on the port bow. Range about 800 yards.
Sound general quarters. All engines ahead, two-thirds.
Snorkel bearing 090.
Head directly for the snorkel.
Well, let's now venture beyond Malta's murky depths as we discover some films to truly highlight film noir and Hollywood's golden oldies. First up, here's the opening of one of Hollywood's most celebrated noirs, iconically featuring, as they so often do, and as Anthony mentioned in our interview, the voiceover.
It was on a side road outside of Los Angeles. I was hitchhiking from San Francisco down to San Diego, I guess. A half hour earlier, I thumbed a ride.
Well, so long, mister. Thanks for the ride, the three cigarettes, and for not laughing at my theories on life.
But you broke off right in the middle of a sentence. Why do you keep looking for new places, new people, new ideas?
Well, I never liked any job I ever had. Maybe the next one is the one I've always been looking for.
Not worried about your future?
Well, I got plenty of time for that. Besides, maybe my future starts right now.
Well, good luck. Maybe I'll be seeing you again.
Thanks for the ride, mister.
Yes, a drifter lands a job in a roadside diner with an avuncular old owner, but the water's soon muddy when the new hand meets said owner's wife. From 1946, this is Tay Garnett's classic noir drama, The Postman Always Rings Twice. Doubtless familiar to our more seasoned listeners, that title will probably ring a bell, even to those of you who've not seen the film yet. Now, this movie was remade in 1981 in a version starring Jessica Lange and Jack Nicholson, but here we're talking about the earlier version, starring none other than the iconic Lana Turner, aged just 25 at the time of this film's release.
Guess I'm not even I thought I was. Or else I wouldn't have been so scared.
I'm plenty scared, too.
When all the lights went out, I was just a little girl again, afraid of the dark. But from now on, you'll be the brains of this outfit, and I'll work. I'll work so hard for this place, Frank.
We can't make any plans till we find out about Nick.
Yeah, no.
Answer it.
Well, this is an interesting one to start with, being made now some 75 years ago. That's more years than most people on Earth will be alive. Crikey, that's a bit depressing, isn't it? But anyway, perhaps one of the barriers deterring younger film viewers from old classics like this is the performance style, which was arguably a little more formulaic and rigid in a lot of films of this era. That's a shame, though, because there's a tremendous amount to appreciate in this movie's ostensibly innocent tale. That's one of the delights of the film, really, adapted from a novel by James M. Cain, who actually wrote many noir novels that were adapted into movies. Here, we at first rather wonder where that darkness lies. But in a fine example to modern cinematic plot weavers, we're soon entwined in an intrigue leading us down an ominous rabbit hole.
Look at that gate. She's boiling over. You're going to ruin this car, Mrs. Smith.
Well, do you think I'd better pull over and let it cool off?
Sure, girl. Pull over and stop. We got to save this little bus to take us to Canada.
Hey, Nick, what happened to your voice? We're going pretty good, huh?
Me, and there is a tavern in the town, where my true love lives.
The movie co-stars Cecil Kellaway with John Garfield playing the new lad in town. But dibs here must go to Turner, who is nothing short of scintillating in this performance. Look, there are many very fine actors working today, but it's tough to imagine a better inspiration for young performers than the work of Lana Turner. Witness an actress whose eyes alone can speak encyclopedic volumes about what her character is feeling, and that in just a brief instant of on-screen time. It's remarkable work. I've rarely seen anything quite like it. John Garfield, as her lover, does his very best, but it honestly feels like he's just trying to keep up with Turner for most of the film. It's worth watching just to observe that dynamic alone. So if you've yet to experience it, then buckle in for Lana Turner's tremendous dramatic presence in The Postman Always Rings Twice.
There's one thing we could do that would fix everything for us.
What? Pray?
Something like that.
Car.
Well, you suggested it yourself once, didn't you?
I was only joking.
Were you?
Yes, I was.
Or had you started to think about it a little?
Maybe I said it, but I didn't really mean it.
Well, I say it again now, and I do mean it. Frank, listen to me. I'm not what you think I am. I've made a big mistake in my life, and I've got to be this way just once to fix it.
Our next movie today is arguably even more famous than that previous one. The opening has been imitated, satirized, and riffed upon in literally dozens of paler imitations since the 50s. It's an opening which, true to form, plays out once again to the dulcet tones of a voiceover.
Yes, this is Sunset Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. That's the homicide squad, complete with detectives and newspapermen. A murder has been reported from one of those great big houses in the 10,000 block. You'll read about it in the late editions, I'm sure. Because an old-time star is involved. One of the biggest.
Of course, this is Billy Wilder's 1950 noir Sunset Boulevard, starring Gloria Swanson and William Holden. Well, 'tis intriguing, this one. The name of the film, for me, implied sweeping sets and citywide outdoor drama. But once the undeniably noirish opening is established, this settles into a surprisingly self-contained character study of a movie.
Heather Harper speaking. I'm talking from the bedroom of Norma Desmond. Don't bother with a rewrite, man. Take this direct. Ready? As day breaks over the murder house.
Yes, you'll read the big black headlines about Norma Desmond and this Hollywood scandal. But you'll never read the true story about the rest of us who were part of it. Me, for instance. Joe Gillis, a promising young writer from Dayton, Ohio. And Betty, that nice kid I met at a Hollywood party, who knew nothing about me, but knew what she wanted.
Told essentially as a post-mortem flashback, this story is, delightfully, one of the earliest meta-movies about the Hollywood film industry. It really centers on the desperate machinations of one of those memorable tropes in cinema, the washed-out, ailing Hollywood starlet.
Wait a minute, haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I knew there was something wrong.
Yes, the tragic figure that is Norma Desmond has been eclipsed by the end of the silent movie era, vanquished, if you will, by the almighty audio microphone. In a performance that, by modern standards, might at times seem to border on the melodramatic, Swanson's turn is actually totally compelling, almost impossible to turn away from, in fact.
They're dead. They're finished. There was a time in this business when they had the eyes of the whole wide world. But that wasn't good enough for them. Oh, no. They had to have the ears of the world, too. So they opened their big mouths, and out came talk. Talk, talk!
That's where the popcorn business comes in. You buy yourself a bag and plug up your ears.
Look at them in the front offices. The masterminds. They took the idols and smashed them. The Fairbankses, the Gilberts, the Valentinos. And who have we got now? Some nobody.
Don't blame me. I'm not an executive, just a writer.
William Holden does really strong work as the other lead in this drama. Indeed, the supporting cast are all enjoyable, something of an ensemble piece as this is. But really, the power of the movie is in its observation of the workings of an obsessive mind, absolutely hell-bent as she is on reattaining her long-lost fame, and that by any means necessary. It makes for a pimping good yarn.
Well, we should have lived happily ever after, like they do in the movies. But this was different. Because this is a Hollywood story about the people who make the movies. The little ones that you never hear of, like Betty and me. The great ones, like Cecil B. DeMille. All those who knew Norma Desmond, a strange woman who left her mark on all of us, who crossed her path. Has it ever occurred to you that I may have a life of my own, that there may be some girl that I'm crazy about?
Yes, the sultry dame soon realizes that her newfound scrivener might offer her dramatic deliverance and then some. She decides that as her lover, the writer can reinstall her as the queen of movie performers once more.
What I'm trying to say is that I'm all wrong for you. You want a Valentino, somebody with polo ponies, a big shot.
What you're trying to say is you don't want me to love you. Say it. Say it.
Gloria Swanson, one of the great personalities of this generation in a role that comes to an actress once in a lifetime. Rising to the heights, William Holden creates a startling portrayal. And a new star is born in Sunset Boulevard, Miss Nancy Olsen.
Joe? Where are you? What's this all about?
Why don't you come out and see for yourself? The address is 10,086 Sunset Boulevard.
Undoubtedly a movie of yesteryear, you'll find few better examples of performance integrated into a seamlessly staged production. It's one which, to be sure, does feature several large scenes with very considerable casts of extras to boot. So take a trip down memory lane and enjoy, nine, shake thine head in sorrow at the lamentable but compelling story that once took place on Sunset Boulevard.
You are writing words. Words, small words. Well, you've made a rope of words and strangled this business. But there's a microphone right there to catch the last gurgles. And Technicolor to photograph the red swollen tongue.
You wake up the monkey.
Get out! Max!
Next time I'll bring my autograph album along. Or maybe a hunk of cement and ask for your footprint.
And let's enjoy a brief excerpt from the suitably dramatic musical theme of Sunset Boulevard now, composed by Franz Waxman.
Thank you.
Venturing a little off the beaten track for our next movie, we switch from the black and white of our previous two films to Technicolor now. The wife of a wealthy man gets caught off guard and is forced to make a terrible decision that will have tragic ramifications for the rest of her life.
In blazing headlines and sensational trials, she faced the world as Madame X. Producer Ross Hunter and the star Lana Turner of Imitation of Life and Portrait in Black combine talents to bring you another deep emotional experience. A triumph of acting for Hollywood's most glamorous star.
From 1966, this is David Lowell Rich's largely forgotten drama, Madame X. And we had played a snippet from this film's lovely soundtrack music a little bit earlier on in the show. And yes, you heard right. This is our second movie today starring Lana Turner. To be sure, this is a far lesser known performance by Turner, made much later in her acting career, a full 20 years after her star-making turn in The Postman Always Rings Twice. Here in her mid-40s, Turner's voice has deepened, and so has her performing talent. I mean, this is a quite astonishing leading role.
Co-starring John Forsythe as Clay, loving, handsome, rich. But he was never there when she needed him most.
Where have you been?
Where have you been?
It's fair enough.
Ricardo Montalban as Phil, who tempted her.
Why, you contemptible rotten...
Contemptible rotten what? Never end on a dangling insult.
Please let me go.
If you promise not to leave.
Well, here we have a fine example of classic movie form. There's the briefest moment during the opening minutes when we wonder where the tale is headed. But the goings-on in the cavernous, high-ceilinged mansion soon show us the villain of the piece. It's a compelling setup, and one which, once you've seen it, you'll surely feel that you need to follow through right to the bitter end.
Constance Bennett as Estelle, who betrayed Madame X.
You're an unfit mother guilty of adultery.
No!
I'll fight you with every breath in my body before I'll let you take my child.
You have no child.
Burgess Meredith as Dan, who degraded her.
What do you want me to say, Dan?
The truth. Tell him who you are.
Betty Miller.
Drunken rat!
Part of the reason I've included Madame X in the lineup today is to showcase something of the evolution of dramatic movies through the 40s and into the 60s. Alas, the clips of dialogue in this film's trailer were really limited for today's show, I'm sorry to say. But in Turner's performance here, we can observe how cinema was approaching the more naturalistic performing and indeed framing that's now so much more prevalent in the 20th century films that followed this very formative era. Turner's Madame X is a character arc going through a staggering sequence of changes. I mean, the dramatic range required of this role is really enormous. Turner truly proves what a stunning talent she was, particularly as a more mature actress. Her sallow-faced descent to destitution is devastating. This film literally had me in tears before I was even at the midway point. Indeed, I challenge you to keep a dry eye.
My client doesn't ask for her life. I ask it.
This is Lana Turner's movie, not a shred of doubt about it. But she's got fine support. As mentioned in the clip, Ricardo Montalban makes an appearance. Now, he went on to play the eponymous, sneering, silver-locked villain in the second Star Trek motion picture, The Wrath of Khan. There's also Burgess Meredith. He trained Rocky how to box in Stallone's classic 1976 sports drama. But Meredith also worked here in Malta in the classic 1981 fantasy adventure Clash of the Titans, which we discussed in a previous episode of our show. And Keir DeLay went on to star in Stanley Kubrick's classic 1968 sci-fi adventure 2001 A Space Odyssey. A superlative cast, then, and a heartbreaking turn by Lana Turner. Don't miss the criminally unknown 60s drama that is Madame X.
Oh, child, don't fight any longer. I killed Denzel.
Ah. Our final film today jumps right up to 1978. Now, that was such a fertile time in cinema, with plenty of juicy genre flicks being made. Arguably, the 70s and 80s were really the bridge between those classic decades of Hollywood filmmaking and the more modern aesthetic of 20th century film, which most of us today predominantly tend to immerse ourselves in. Lately, I was hankering for a supernatural movie about the curse of Tutankhamun, the Egyptian pharaoh. I didn't actually find one, but I did instead unearth Egypt-bound death and mystery in this movie.
Murder? Now, join the most brilliant detective of all time,
Hercule Poirot,
on a mysterious journey down the Nile to the great wonders of the world, where the biggest wonder of them all is whodunit.
I feel the presence of evil all about me.
Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile.
So, this is the 1978 movie adaptation of the famous murder mystery novel, originally published way back in 1937. And well, Agatha Christie adaptations are no stranger to Malta. Back in episode 4 of the first season of our show, we discussed Kenneth Branagh's Murder on the Orient Express, partially shot here in Malta in 2017. That film was itself a remake of a 1974 movie. Well, Branagh apparently got a taste for Agatha Christie mysteries. He's working on another remake, this time of today's film, Death on the Nile. That remake is currently slated for a 2022 release and stars Wonder Woman's Gal Gadot. It should be mentioned that neither that version of Death on the Nile or the one we're discussing today were actually shot here in Malta. It's Murder on the Orient Express, the remake, that was. But it doesn't end there. There was also a British feature-length TV episode of Death on the Nile made in 2004, starring, of course, David Suchet. Staying with our 1978 film, though, here Peter Ustinov gives an intriguing and bewitching turn as the infamous Belgian detective. He's joined by a huge all-star cast from that era, including an effortless supporting turn by veteran British actor David Niven, adding just a hint of much-needed irony and comic relief to the rather grim proceedings.
Colonel Rhys! Oh, I'm enchanted to see you.
Oh, my old friend. How capital, how capital.
Yes.
Oh, I haven't clapped eyes on you since... Oh, that strange affair of the decapitating clergyman.
Yes, yes.
I still think you were a trifle lucky to find that cake knife up the chimney like that.
Lucky? With me, it's the exercise of the little grey cells. Luck, I leave to the others.
Yes, I've forgotten your opinion about yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you're familiar with Agatha Christie's brand of murder mystery, you'll see a tried and tested structural formula applied here. A panoply of characters are drawn out, each of whom has, of course, a plausible motive for knocking off our eventual victim. George Kennedy, Mia Farrow, Angela Lansbury, yes, She of Murder, She Wrote, Olivia Hussey, a young Maggie Smith, and even Betty Davis are all amongst the suspicious-looking passengers of the luxury steamliner.
You have got to forgive Miss Bowles. She's just unfamiliar with the marriage state. I saw you drooling over her pearls.
Shut up, Bowles.
You'd give every tooth in your head to lay your hands on them.
What nonsense, just because you've got a grudge against her, or rather her father. No need to be uncivil.
Grudge? Malouche Ridgway ruined my family.
Well, you should be grateful. If he hadn't, you'd have missed the pleasure of working for me.
Could kill her on that score alone.
Death on the Nile. Does that mean just a single death? Who can say? Regardless, as is also the wont of the genre, the film, with it must be said an unusually long runtime, shows our indomitable sleuth interviewing each passenger in turn, laying out his logic and suspicions as he goes.
Yes, of course, but it could have been someone else with a motive at least as good.
Oh, who?
You, Madame Ackerbourne.
What are you talking about?
Oh, come, come. Both your daughter and you know that you cannot libel the dead. Now you'll never have to pay those huge damages she was asking for.
Yes, but one would hardly kill for that.
Would one not? You know, Mrs. Ackerbourne, it is you that I can see looking into the saloon through the windows. at that, as you put it, poor half-crazed Jacqueline.
It's sumptuously shot and staged with lovely location photography for your widescreen telly. The plot is nicely paced and the cast is strong. Arguably, Mia Farrow and Lansbury overdo it a little bit in places, albeit rather enjoyably so. Sure enough, in the third act denouement, our detective pieces together the clues of this seemingly intractable mystery. And despite its formulaic trappings, I was very pleasantly surprised at the unpredictability of this story. Unlike Murder on the Orient Express, which felt a little more pat to me, in Death of the Nile, in contrast, the writer exposits traps both laid by and fallen into for one character after another. 'Tis intriguing, mind-bending stuff. So for an enjoyable crime mystery romp that's a bridge movie from the film noir era to more modern picks, don thine enormous mustache and take a look as...
Now, the most daring, the most deadly case of his career challenges... Hercule Poirot.
It was carefully planned.
To guess who in the world done it.
But I, Hercule Poirot, have eyes which notice everything.
Mystery in first class. Murder with style. Agatha Christie's... Death on the Nile.
So, what did you think of the movie selection in today's show? For that or any other feedback, please email us at morethanamovieqs@gmail.com. That's morethanamovieqs, all one word, @gmail.com. This More Than a Movie episode was written and presented by me, Andrew Bonello. A big thanks to our guest, Anthony Edridge, for joining us today. And, of course, to our sound engineer, Redent Abdillah. The intro music was Creepy Comedy, and the outro is Inspiring Teaser, both by Raphael Crux at filmmusic.io. The clips are licensed under creativecommons.org, version 4. Thanks so much for listening, and I do hope you'll join us again next week for another episode of More Than a Movie.